Good afternoon. It's a privilege for me to be here at ATS to present some of the findings of my ongoing research. This is part of my PhD project that I'm doing since last year, as I had the privilege to start this study in the Hebrew University, and was suggested by a teacher of mine in combination with Dr. Gain, as I was talking with him, that my interest of research is about the interpretation of Daniel 8, especially in the history of Christianity. We know as Adventists, the most scholars, how they interpret the little horn or the Antichrist. And I enter in this study to take another perspective, to look at the context in the Jewish Second Temple Jewish literature, to understand the milieu of how an enemy or how the agent of contamination in the temple was considered by this literature. So let me see. Most interpreters, as you know, put the little horn or the Antichrist power as Antiochus IV Epiphanes as the enemy in the temple. And Second Thessalonians, most interpreters says that Paul, or the author of the Epistle of Second Thessalonians, uses the imagery of Daniel, which they consider as the Antiochus IV Epiphanes, but just as a symbol, of course, because it's later, as an enemy power, which they consider as the Roman power in the time of Paul. So the basic assumption of this interpretation, as Adventists we know, the Vaticinium ex eventu, they don't believe in predicted prophecy, and prophetic for them is just limited to the geopolitical times of the altar. So the problems, as we know as Adventists, that the Romans did not necessarily enter the temple in the time of Paul, and even if they put the year 70, they did not necessarily enter the temple before the destruction started. Actually, Josephus described quite clearly that what started the defilement of the temple was the Jews themselves who were inside. So this needs to be somewhat redefined, and the imagery is similar to the level also of persecution. The strength, however, is that those scholars take the immediate historical context to inform what this enemy, this figure of the enemy in the temple represents. But for me, they do not go far enough to describe what the little horn or what the Antichrist or the enemy, as I categorize the enemy in the temple figure in apocalyptic literature, is. As the interpreters, we interpret the Daniel in continuation with Second Thessalonians. We say that this represents the same power in prophetic history, in prophetic interpretation. The temple of God, we interpret the temple of God in history, in post-biblical times, not necessarily in the time of Daniel or in the time of the author of Second Thessalonians, but we take a different approach because we see the continuous of prophetic interpretation in history going to the end of time. The strength, as you may agree, is to look to the historical fulfillment, which we think is coherent with the biblical text. But, and this is where I started my research, our prophetic studies has kind of a lack of a historical context of the biblical authors, especially with the Second Temple literature, like Old Testament, Pseudepigrapha, and Qumran. Frum was one of the first who did more of this work in prophetic faith of our fathers. But because he wrote in the 50s, he did not have access to the discoveries of Qumran. So here we have the possibility to explore even further. The purpose of my ongoing study, I did first my studies on the Pseudepigrapha, and then I did another research on some documents of the Dead Sea Scrolls. I covered the Damascus document and the community rule, and I'm currently doing the Temple Scroll and the Scroll of War. So I'm looking into what contaminates the sanctuary as a background to understand this apocalyptic enemy, which both in Daniel 8 and in 2 Thessalonians represents very clearly this enemy in the temple, and this is what defiles the sanctuary. So the goal of this research, this ongoing research, is to identify this concept of agents of purity or impurity as framework to understand the imagery of the temple, And I have limited myself, of course, until the present. I'm going to continue in the future doing my studies, not only to the Second Temple literature, but also with the church fathers to analyze this more carefully, this imagery more carefully. The relevance of this study, at least, seems obvious for me, that issue of purity and impurity related to prophetic interpretation relates, as we know well, to soteriology, the doctrine of salvation, with the ministry of Christ in the heavenly sanctuary, ecclesiology, how we define church or a sanctuary, especially in prophecy. This has been the kind of the most used language to define a church, especially with the pioneers, to define Rome first, or what is the the non-Christian power, and then the Adventists come as a counter movement, as a remnant to counteract this movement raised by Satan, as we call the apostatized Christianity. So the implication for ecclesiology and eschatology also are big. So Qumran, why I'm choosing Qumran and the Old Testament pseudepigrapha, but especially Qumran, I would stress that they have quite a similar view to Adventists in respect to eschatology. They believe that Jesus was coming very soon. They believe themselves to be part of the remnant of Israel. They fled to a place to not be contaminated by the majority of the religious group, the Jews in Jerusalem. So and there are more relations that I have developed in the past to that point, to me at least, that this comparison between our understanding of prophecy and their understanding of prophecy can be very fruitful. So here you go, my little introduction, and then I'm going to go to the text really quick, and then I do my conclusion. The important background of the study is their concept of a sanctuary, and we have to understand this, that the basic concept of a temple is the presence of God. And you have this description, especially in the book of Jubilee, which is taken as a general pattern for the other Old Testament pseudepigrapha, and I think also it applies to the Qumran material, that you have God being mobile, or with the tabernacle in the time of Moses. You have this in the tabernacle, walking into the promised land. And this is going to become fixed, the presence of God, only with the construction of the temple with David and Solomon. Okay? And then exile, in the book of Ezekiel, you see the glory of God moving again where the people go. So again, the presence of God or the temple of God is mobile. And only when they come back with Ezra and Nehemiah and the temple is rebuilt, that the presence of God is again fixed. But as many studies in the book of Ezra and Malachi and in the Second Temple period has demonstrated, I don't have time to show that, they still have this, what one author called the posture of exile. Even though they had the temple, many of the Jewish groups didn't believe that the presence of God was in the Second Temple. Okay? So you have this kind of expectation that when the real temple, the real presence of God will come to Jerusalem, even though the temple was constructed. So they have they still have that, what some author calls exilic posture, that the presence of God is not established in Jerusalem even after the return. And you have this debate, because Jerusalem or the temple in Jerusalem is not pure yet for some groups, especially during the Hasmonean period in the time of Maccabees. So the concept is that this is developed very well in the book of Jubilees. God dwells in purity, right? So he brings judgment, and you have the Day of Atonement to remove all the impurities, because God is a holy being. And he leaves, like in the book of Ezekiel, in the exile, when there is destruction, when there is impurity, God leaves and the temple is destroyed. So the question is, when is the temple contaminated? This is the question of prophecy in Daniel 8 and 2 Thessalonians 2. In the Damascus document, and then I will go very quickly here. There are 5 clear references. I search all the references where it appears the expression purity or impurity in the context of sanctuary. So when you have the word sanctuary, I looked in the context to see where it appears the reference to purity, and I found 5 clear references, to demonstrate that impurity means disobedience, general disobedience. When you disobey God, you bring impurity into the temple. And especially this general disobedience is characterized one time as sexual immorality. The general is lie, falseness, pride. You have one of the texts here in your handout, the Damascus document, column 3, verse 13 and 19. God reveals secret things to Israel, includes the holy Sabbath and his glorious feasts, and he desires of his will which a man must do in order to live, yet they wallow in their sins. So sins in general, in the ways of uncleanliness, and when you take this expression uncleanness in the context, they are connected to the Sabbath. And when you go to analyze more carefully the commandments of the Sabbath in the Damascus document, you see how you can bring uncleanliness or break the Sabbath in the mentality of the Qumranites in this document, is that no man shall willingly mingle with another in the Sabbath, and this another is clearly a Gentile. So no man shall spend the Sabbath in a place near a Gentile. So how you bring contamination in the breaking the Sabbath and bring contamination to the temple according to this document is pretty much having contact with a Gentile, but not only physical contact. It's the meaning of idolatry or pagan practices. In the community rule, there is no explicit reference to the defilement of the sanctuary. Gentile is never mentioned in this document as an agent of contamination. And there are six different references to defilement. As the previous document, there is this general notion, when you disobey God, you bring defilement, and it's a human condition of disobedience. So you bring an example. There is only one clear example where this disobedience is connected to a specific commandment, and this commandment is idolatry, as you can see in the handout, and I put even more examples in the handout for you. I'm going to run really quick. I'm doing right now, I study in the temple scroll, and the temple scroll is a little more complex than that. It's not only connected to Gentile practices and idolatry, but it brings the abomination of pagans as a whole issue of lifestyle that brings impurity into the temple. So I'm not going to dwell a lot of my time here, because the issue is more complex that I'm dealing with. But what I know so far is that they still have this concept of abomination as a pagan practice, that when an Israelite enters into contact with this group and brings into the realm of the sanctuary, they bring contamination. So you have Gentile practices as not only evil deeds, but also as evil words. In the Old Testament pseudepigrapha, in my findings on the texts that refers to the sanctuary and contamination together, I found that the most prominent agent of contamination is sexual immorality, which means relationship between Israelite and a Gentile. And the paradigmatic text in the Book of Jubilee is the retelling of the story of Dinah and the rape of Dinah there in the Book of Genesis with the Shechemites. And you have also this debate that they are maybe the author of the Book of Jubilee is playing with this issue in the time of Ezra against the Samaritans in Nehemiah, where they are not willing to bring the Samaritans to rebuild the temple. There's a lot written out there about this. So this is important. Why? Because this story shows that even when you have this current theme of a Gentile, of an outsider, as the one who contaminates the temple, actually is when an Israelite brings this outsider to the Israelite camp that the Gentile contaminates. It's not a voluntary coming of a Gentile to bring contamination to the temple, but it's a passive one. And this is consistently, I have seen this throughout the Old Testament pseudepigrapha and the Dead Sea Scrolls. So, and this seems to be the pattern also from the Book of Deuteronomy, where God commands the Israelites not to give their daughters, for example, to marry foreign people. Why? Because they would bring contamination to the camp. And you have that story in the Book of Numbers where the priest Phinehas has to kill that Israelite with the prostitute who is brought into the camp, bringing immorality and impurity into the camp of God. So what I have concluded so far is that even though the Gentile is one of the most important agents of contamination, bringing sexual immorality and idolatry in some documents of Qumran and in the Old Testament pseudepigrapha, the enemies actually are mostly described as insiders or a Gentile who are brought into the camp through an Israelite. So this blurred the category of what is the people of God, and the Gentile figure is a passive as a judgment of God as the Babylonians in the prophetic literature. So I have seen a progression so far. I'm still investigating the Dead Sea Scrolls to see if this progression continues to be true. All have general categories. If you disobey God, you bring defilement. But as you narrow down these texts, there are specific sins or disobedience that brings defilement to the temple of God. This is sexual immorality that brings Gentile or idolatry of practices, and also the issue of an evil tongue or false prophecy that a Gentile will lie or brings false prophecy and ask you to follow other gods. So the Gentiles are idolaters as outsider. As you progress in time in this Second Temple literature, it becomes an insider. In the Old Testament pseudepigrapha, the focus was the outsider, but as you move in the Qumranic literature, it becomes more and more the concern of the Jews to take care of the impurity inside of the community. Those who are part of us and contaminated have to be expelled. So I have seen this progression so far. And what are the implications for this? Let's see if it is. Oh. Can you change now for the word? And I'm going to read just like three paragraphs and then I'll be done. Not so quick. You just have to start out. Oops. Can you go to the Word document? Yes, please. In this investigation of contamination agents in the Second Temple, it is seen that in the Old Testament pseudepigrapha and apocrypha, Jews are more worried about Gentile practices, physical agents of contamination such as idolatry and sexual immorality brought in by Jews, Jewish accommodation to foreign practices. In the Damascus document, this is still something to be worried about in this community, but there is an increased vigilance about non-physical agents of contamination, as evil words, offering of witness. I have put some of the quotations here in your handout. This is a transition document in the Qumran sect, and as many scholars have tried to demonstrate, this is one of the foundation documents in the Qumran sect, one of the first ones. By the time the Qumran, the rule of the community was written, the major notion of internal evil is not anymore of Gentile practices. I suggest that this fits well in the context of the Hasmonean control of the Judean, when there is a Jewish schism in Jerusalem about the rituals of the temple, as the Damascus Cross tells it. As this schism became acute, the major enemies of God in the sanctuary for those who left the Jerusalem were the insiders and not outsiders. In Qumran, it is Jews connected to the sanctuary. Can you scroll down, please? In Jerusalem, who brings the spirit of wickedness to God's territory. And like the other Second Temple literature, like the Old Testament pseudepigrapha and apocrypha, the Gentile presence is a passive one. For they are the judgments of God to punish, like the Babylonians in the book of Habakkuk, to punish the wicked who profess, the wicked Jews who profess to be godly in the temple of God. This opens new venues to the understanding of the figure of the Antichrist in the non-Adventist circles, especially related to 2 Thessalonians 2, as part of a second temple milieu of contextual imagination. I started this investigation questioning the major presupposition and background information that informs the non-Adventist commentaries in 2 Thessalonians 2. They consider Daniel as a product of the Maccabean revolt, which we reject and ignore the great exile background of the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem by the Babylonians. Thus, they focus on the role of a Gentile persecuting power represented by Antiochus and not on insiders. But as this study has demonstrated, for Jews in the Second Temple period, the Gentile presence in the sanctuary is a passive one, and the foreign persecuting power motif is almost absent as characteristic of those who defile the sanctuary. And this is an important thing for the non-historicists to consider. And I finish. Can you go down so I can read the last two paragraphs, please? OK. Can you go down? Yeah. The study of Michael Newton about Spirit in Qumran and Paul has demonstrated that they are very similar. This is particularly, I quote, the case of the level of purity and the divine presence in the temple. He also highlights that both Pauline and Qumranic literature saw their respective community as the sanctuary and that they employed the concept of purity drawn from the biblical tradition. And finally, that the theme of purity and impurity was the principle who shaped their identity, liturgical and ecclesiastical practice by determining who and what is in or out of the community of God. Although he does not mention 2 Thessalonians 2:4 in his study, Newton, what it can imply is that since the notion of contamination and purification are very similar in theory and practice, this can illuminate the understanding of the figure of the Antichrist in the temple as the agent of contamination in biblical apocalyptic prophecy, contrary to Jenks, which is a major preterist scholar, and similar authors. Then if this is true, the implications for Christianity is that the study of prophecy and the rituals of the sanctuary related to it is important for the practices of the church, as Newton has already suggested, that this was actually the method of Paul in his ecclesiological practices, as in the community of Qumran and in the early church, the sanctuary was still a major source of religious practice. And I finish, can you go down to, yeah. The rituals of the sanctuary not only shaped their present or ecclesiological practices, but also their eschatological aspirations. Their eschatology was the description of an earthly period of evil when the sanctuary was passive to contamination. But the end is a heavenly intervention when God, from His heavenly and pure abode, will bring celestial status to earth by purifying the earthly sanctuary, where only those who have been purifying His life through faithfulness to the commandments of God will dwell. Their fear of contamination may still be a warning for believers today. They teach that we need to be more afraid of those who are among us than those who are outsiders. How the religious community should deal with this internal threat is a challenge that Judaism and Christianity have been struggling for centuries and will do until the end.